The Tom Woods Show, episode 2072.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, a lot of your friends believe that deregulation caused the financial crisis of 2008 just as fervently as they believe that lockdowns are the solution to COVID-19. For the sake of our future, both of these ideas need to be smashed, so check out my free ebook, The Deregulation Boogeyman, over at regulationmyths.com. Hi everybody, Tom Woods here. I'm very glad to have the great and heroic James Lindsay back on the program. No doubt you know him, especially these days, as maybe the premier opponent of critical race theory out there, or at the very least, he's among a small handful of people you're most likely to be familiar with. And he's got a brand new book called Race Marxism, The Truth About Critical Race Theory and Praxis, that I thought for sure you'd want to hear about. So James, welcome back.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
All right, let me ask you a slightly off-the-wall question, but why did you decide to self-publish this book? Wouldn't there be huge demand for a book like this right now?
Yes, and in fact, there were offers. The reason was speed, actually. I'm looking at what's going on in society, and I figure that we're kind of at an inflection point with the issue of critical race theory. And so I talked to a couple of agents and a couple of publishers, and you know, they gave me timelines that I thought might be a little bit slow for the kind of importance of the issue. I also am running my own company, New Discourses. You know, I created an imprint within that. So I kind of wanted to see what it would do for the company to take this route as a bit of an experiment. So those are the two primary reasons.
It's interesting that here in the internet age, where everything happens at lightning speed, traditional publishers still have this snail's pace when it comes to releasing books.
Yeah, I understand they have to do their trade the way they want to do their trade or whatever, but it's a massive impediment, in my opinion, for something like this, when you have a very timely book or a political book, for example, to have a 5 or 6 or 9 or 12 month kind of marketing window where the manuscript has already been delivered and largely finalized and still nearly a year before the book comes to print.
I agree. I had a book on the financial crisis of 2008. I'm not going to wait a year for that book to come out. The moment is gone by then, you know? So I found a publisher that it was a crazy situation wanting to rush it out there. I was able to find one publisher that was willing to turn the book around like in a couple of months. And I said, okay, great. I don't care how fast I have to go. But that's highly, highly unusual. So I'm glad you went this route, and I hope it is a big success for you. You have a couple of definitions early on in the book, and the simpler one is on page 10. Critical race theory is the belief that racism that benefits white people, parentheses, white supremacy, is the fundamental organizing principle of society, and that this is bad. Now, you were suggesting just now when I asked you about why you self-published that you're watching what's going on in society, and you're obviously alarmed by it. And I don't remember where, but somewhere early on, you suggest that civilization itself could in some way be at stake here. How can that be? How is this issue that important?
Well, if you believe what's on the cover of the book, that this is race Marxism, then what you must understand is that what erupted in 2020 was the beginning of the kinetic beginning, I should say, of the Cultural Revolution, premised off of a race Marxist attempt to remake the country, to remake America, to remake the West. And so Western civilization has now been placed under attack. We're approaching 2 years into this attack, and Marxists, they play for keeps. And so if you accept the premise of the book, that critical race theory is race Marxism, and you accept that what happened at the end of May and beginning of June in 2020 was the transition from a theoretical to a practical cultural revolution premised upon critical race theory through the Black Lives Matter movement, particularly after the death of George Floyd, then you must understand that we are at tremendous risk. We are a year and a half, almost 2 years into a legitimate cultural revolution. The fate of Western civilization teeters in the balance.
The idea that ours or the United States is a white supremacist society seems basically laughable to almost any normal person. I was just thinking of the example of what's happened in Canada. If you donated some trivial amount to this trucker convoy, well, they're going to make your life absolutely miserable. And they're going to demonize you. They're going to dox you. They're going to harass you and hound you people who participated in the thing were being threatened that their ability to engage in banking and basic functions of society would be taken from them. Now, if we lived in a white supremacist society, it seems to me that donors to Black Lives Matter would have had that happen to them. They would have been doxxed and threatened. Instead, they were praised and lionized. So we can clearly see, if this were a white supremacist society, that's how they'd be treated. But they're not. They're fawned over, and every official outlet of opinion, practically, is on their side. How are they able to portray this as nevertheless white supremacy?
You are correct. We even can look back to things we have documentation of from the 1950s when racial integration and desegregation were taking place. We actually have video documentation and photographic documentation of these events in a white supremacist society, in a society that is truly upholding an ideology of white supremacy. The correct response to, say, an uprising like we saw with BLM in 2020 would have been shut up, racial epithet. Sit down, racial epithet. Get out, racial epithet. It would not have been what we saw. We have the exact opposite. But I actually just said the key word as to how this works. And this is, you know, the premise of why I believe we're dealing with race Marxism and critical race theory. And that key word is ideology. It takes a little bit to understand. The key ideology for Marx was what he called capitalism. Capitalism is a word that we, especially libertarians, et cetera, really like. But it actually is a word that was coined by Marx to describe the ideology that capital in a market should organize society. And so what Marx saw was that there were certain people who are winners in society and certain people who are losers. The superstructure were the winners of society and the infrastructure were the losers of society. The proletariat, the working class were being exploited by the managerial class, the bourgeoisie and the capitalists. And the people in that position of power and advantage create what he called an ideology to justify their position. It's kind of a broad overarching mythology with lots of little mythologies like meritocracy and value of education and deservedness and hard work and all of these kinds of things to justify the various parts. But the big one for Marx was capitalism. And it gave you access to what he called bourgeois property in the Communist Manifesto, which was called capital, which is different from other forms of private property, like if you went and made a thing in your kitchen or whatever, the thing that you produced with your own hands and labor, you can have that. That's a different kind of property for Marx. But bourgeois private property is what he called capital. And capitalism is a broad ideology that says, this is how we should organize society. All you have to do is transfer this exact structure over out of class and into race, and you see exactly what I mean. The way the critical race theorists conceive of white supremacy is as the broad overarching ideology that gives some people access to a kind of property called whiteness. Cheryl Harris, a critical race theorist in 1993, wrote a paper called Whiteness as Property. It's like 90 pages long, and I forget if it's a Harvard Law Review, but one of these major law reviews. She characterizes whiteness as a form of bourgeois property that some people, the winners in society, get to have and other people don't. And they created broad overarching ideology that explains why they get to have access to this called white supremacy and why other people are to be excluded from it. It's an exact one-to-one. If I'm a mathematician by training, my old mathematical skills would say this is literally an isomorphism. It is a one-to-one correspondence that preserves all of the structure of Marxist thought, swapping out class and replacing it with race. And that's why they can say we're in a white supremacist society, because what they mean by white supremacy is something utterly fantastical and structural that's defined in terms of the way that Marx thought about how ideologies define and permeate society.
I marked up so much in my, because I copied and pasted bits and pieces of things I wanted to talk about. And then I thought, I don't know, like I'm on page 25. I'm never going to get through this thing. But something struck me on page 50 as the kind of thing that I think most of us have come to associate with this whole way of thinking. You say, predictably, in practice, this doctrine results in squabbling for standing, speaking over people deemed privileged, and constantly scrutinizing whether or not one's claim to an oppressed, thus enlightened, standpoint is valid. That is, it brings out the worst in human tribal behavior over what may be the worst possible basis for human tribalism, race. This tribalism is then strictly enforced such that members of a racial group who do not profess their unique voice of color in the way critical race theory deems authentic are excluded from authority of all sorts. You know, it kind of reminds me, now I can't remember the exact details, but there must have been some observance of Black History Month somewhere in the past where everybody from the area was acknowledged except Clarence Thomas. You know, so it was pretty obvious that the principle you're describing here was at work. But that, of course, is this what's being described here is very, very unhealthy for any society. And yet what we're being told is if we're against this, if we're against critical race theory, that means we don't want slavery to be taught in school. Like they're honestly trying to portray it that way, that that's all we want.
Yeah, this is typical Marxism. This is when Marxism goes into practice and it gets applied, their goal, and you can read this, for example, in 1953 testimony by Bella Dodd, who was a Communist Party USA leader who defected and gave testimony to the House Committee on American Activities, which is now known as the House Judiciary Committee. That's not Joseph McCarthy. He was in the Senate, by the way. People get all worked up.
Right.
Yeah, he was a senator, Senator McCarthy, not in the House. But at any rate, she gave testimony and she said, this is what Marxists do. Is they? She specifically gave another example that's resonant in the current era. She said that they bill themselves, for example, with a very positive sounding terminology and portray themselves as the unique purveyors of that positive thing. And she named specifically, she says that the communists position themselves as being uniquely anti-fascist. And so anybody who opposes communists must therefore be fascist. And they use exactly the same rhetorical trick. Again, mutatis mutandis. It is a perfect one-to-one correspondence from this kind of, in this case, saying anybody who is against them is a fascist because they are uniquely and correctly enlightened to be anti-fascist by their communist theory. And now it's they are uniquely enlightened to be the anti-racist. So anybody who opposes their approach to dealing with race, understanding race, is actually upholding white supremacy in one form or another and is therefore a white supremacist. So which this is why, I mean, you mentioned Clarence Thomas. He was just in the news. One of these New York Times or Washington Post, one of the big ones, just said, I think it was Washington Post, just said, you know, that Clarence Thomas, they said something about him and then they parenthetically described who he is. He's the black Supreme Court justice who usually takes positions held by white supremacists. And this is exactly the kind of thing that you would expect from Marxists who bill themselves as the unique good thing. And anybody who opposes their approach is going to be labeled with kind of the most superficial and simplistic polar opposite of that so-called good thing. We literally could talk about this for over an hour easily, just how preposterous it is. But it is a typical standard Marxist tactic that goes all the way back to the beginning, all the way back to Marx, all the way through Lenin, and virtually everybody else who's ever taken it up.
I have to admit to some skepticism when I saw the title Race Marxism, because I thought, well, look, the economic thing is not just a small adjunct in Marxism. I mean, it deals with surplus value and exploitation theory and stuff like that, and the way history moves and the way revolutions occur and the relationship of different classes to each other. And so it seemed like maybe this is overstating the case because not all these categories can be brought in to an analysis of critical race theory, but there's plenty that can. And as you just said, the way people who disagree are treated, the idea of false consciousness seems to be coming into play. Obviously, Clarence Thomas is either an opportunist or he has false consciousness. Same with anybody who disagrees with them, especially, of course, if they belong to particular groups.
Yeah, I mean, that's the case. I actually was persuaded against my will, if you will, that critical race theory constitutes a reinvention of Marxism. As Gloria Ladson Billings, who's a critical race theorist in education, put it in 1995 in one of her papers, she said that, you know, critical race theory exists to make race the central construct for understanding inequality. So I came to this against my will. I actually, I'm on record in the book we talked about previously, my previous book, Cynical Theories, that I wrote with Helen Pluckrose. We're on record in that book saying this is different than Marxism because of the economic thing, because of the materialist versus constructivist elements. But now I'm convinced that it's actually that it's just evolved. It's very much like if we were to take the engine out of a Corvette and the chassis of a Corvette and put new body panels on it and say, well, it's not really a Corvette anymore. It's something different. Same engine, same mentality, same way of analyzing. But that word, that centering that Gloria Ladson Billings uses is, and you hear that from them all the time. We have to center this. We have to center that. We can't recenter the needs of the privileged and so on. This word centering race as the central construct for understanding inequality becomes so important to understand because what it is it's the same analysis. And if you read, you know, Marxism about race, it says that capitalism exploits races and creates racism. This just inverts that, as one might say, stands it on its head. If we wanted to paraphrase Marx, What it actually does is it says that the class issue is actually derivative from the race issue. Racism is the actual driver. And then, you know, the various economic issues follow from it. And so I was convinced of this reluctantly, I guess. I shouldn't say against my will, by reading copiously through the critical or so-called neo-Marxists of the middle of the 20th century and then reading the critical race theory literature from, you know, mid-1980s forward in particular, very thoroughly, especially the neo-Marxists or the critical Marxists of the 1960s, saying that Herbert Marcuse, for example, saying explicitly that the working class had stabilized, it was building a better life, it has a good life, it's lost its revolutionary potential and has become conservative and counter-revolutionary. So we need a new working class. He says that in his 1969 essay on liberation. We need a new working class. And he says, where do we find it? We find it where the vital energy, the vital needs are. And that's in the ghetto population, as he phrased it. And so he was co-opting what was the kind of Black liberation, Black power, Black nationalism, kind of three overlapping but slightly different movements. He was co-opting that revolutionary energy in the racial minorities, and he cobbled in feminists and the sexual minorities, and the entire identity politics pantheon. What I've been using as a metaphor is that Marxism, it's like you're going down the economic superhighway, and then there's a huge exit ramp into the cultural issues superhighway. And with that essay in Marcuse and the following decade or two of activism and thought, Marxism actually took an exit ramp into cultural issues and completely abandoned the working class. In fact, turned on the working class.
I'm wondering about if there's another analogy with Marxism. Now, Marx's view of labor unions was not favorable because he felt like that's just going to acclimate workers to their own oppression. That they'll get an extra 10 cents an hour and they're too stupid to understand they shouldn't be satisfied with that. Well, likewise, it seems to me critical race theory is leading us down a road not simply to a little bit more affirmative action. You know, obviously something much more radical is on the table. So right now we have a very significant infrastructure for investigating discrimination claims. We have a robust Civil Rights Act and civil rights lawyers as far as the eye can see. And we do have affirmative action in almost every institution in society. And yet we still have critical race theorists saying it's a white supremacist society. So how do they look at the current, I mean, we have affirmative action. Would they view that the way Marx looks at labor unions as just kind of some crumbs thrown to distract the masses from what they truly need, which is a full revolutionary transformation of the whole system?
You will find some people who write it that explicitly and that cynically. Primarily, they see society as having backed away from a much more robust affirmative action that was instituted, you know, in the late 1960s and early 1970s. They actually believe that progress was being made and should have continued to expand, but was in fact contracted. And one could even say this is the reason that critical race theory came into existence, was that through the 1970s and going into the 1980s, especially after the election of Ronald Reagan, that the huge progressive leaps made in the late 60s and through the 70s were being walked back in society. So they actually want a full expansion of this. I would say it goes so far, though, as to reproduce what Marx called the dictatorship. Well, Marx stole this from, what's his name, Weidemeyer or something like this. But the dictatorship of the proletariat being the concept. And you can read that where Kendi says that we need a Department of Anti-Racism that's empowered by constitutional amendment that interprets differences in racial equity as proof of discrimination. So we're now going to rewrite what discrimination is all about and say, if we see differences, it's there. And he says that it would establish a Department of Anti-Racism that would go on to have power over all, to pre-clear, in fact, all local, state, and federal public policy to ensure that racial inequity doesn't arise, to check private policy where racial inequity surfaces, to monitor expressions of racism or racist ideas from public officials where they get to define this, that would be entirely staffed by, he says, formally trained experts on racism, by which being a critical race theorist, he would mean fully staffed by critical race theorists. And that is the establishment of a dictatorship of anti-racists to create an administered economy that achieves what? Equity, the opposite of racial inequity. And so what is equity? It is the redistribution of shares so that groups are made equal, which is exactly what Marx was envisioning would happen with the proletariat. And so I feel as though what they are actually looking at is, in fact, kind of what you said, because you see, like, for example, with the conviction of Derek Chauvin, they said, well, this isn't justice. This is merely accountability. Justice is way further down the line. There's so much more work to do. But what they're actually after is racial justice which is what they call it, which is when racial equity, which means getting all of the outcomes that they want for their program, when that becomes spontaneous in the fundamental organizing principle of society. So they want a complete revolution that puts critical race theory in the driver's seat for how we organize society.
Hey, all you privacy people out there, if you've ever wanted to be nearly invisible online, IPVanish VPN is here to do that for you. If you're tired of feeling like somebody's always watching you on the internet, or maybe advertisers know a little bit more about you than you'd like them to, or you're just concerned about the privacy of your identity, well, incognito mode isn't going to solve your problem. You need IPVanish VPN. IPVanish helps you safely browse the internet without exposing your private details to third parties like hackers, your ISP, or advertisers. And by the way, you can use IPVanish on your computers, tablets, phones, even devices like your Fire Stick when you're streaming media. When you use IPVanish, all your data is encrypted. So this means your private details, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be completely shielded from falling into the wrong hands. Even your physical location will be hidden. You can use IPVanish on unlimited devices without sacrificing your speed. They're offering an incredible 70% off their yearly plan for our listeners with a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's just like getting 9 months for free. IPVanish is super easy to use. All you have to do is tap one button and you're instantly protected. You won't even know what's on. Stop sharing with the world everything you watch, everything you search for, everything you buy. Go to ipvanish.com/woods and use promotional code WOODS and claim your 70% savings. That's ipvanish.com/woods. Toward the end, when you're trying to talk about what then ought to be done, you're trying to encourage people who want to fight back that they need to bear in mind that there is really, maybe you didn't quite put it this way, but there isn't any magical sequence of words you can utter that will make critical race theorists say, oh, you're a good guy. You just have an honorable disagreement with us. That's not possible because by definition, you are a racist if you disagree with them. Just understand that's the way it's set up. So that should defang that word for you because it's just baked into the definition. If you disagree with them, you automatically are this thing. And I hear you. That's a great thing to tell people. But that word racism, for a normal person, you know, a genuine person of goodwill, wishes no one ill will. I can already hear the critical race theorists laughing at me. You're the worst of the racists because you deny. Yeah. Just shut up. The average person, I think, really is a person of goodwill. And I think that being called that does sting for that reason. Nobody wants to be accused of hating whole classes of people. And I think the CRT people, I wonder if they actually do realize that. And they're just cynically using the word because they think it'll shut people up. Because they think, number one, it'll hurt them. Personally, it'll hurt them. And secondly, publicly, it'll hurt them because it'll damage their reputation. I mean, what do you think's being done? What do you think's going on? What is the dynamic here when they use that word?
I mean, you've described it. I don't want to be, you know, I'm not a mind reader, so I can't say whether this person or that person is using it cynically or if they've drank enough of the Kool-Aid to where they actually believe that this is how it is and that they've become, you know, kind of so thoroughly convinced of the idea that everything that disagrees with them is upholding racism through these kind of various weird systemic, you know, superpowers or whatever of society, societal organization. The structuralist thinking is what it's called in the academic literature, that they genuinely believe it. So I don't know when people are cynical and when people aren't, but I know that it's very easy for a cynic to use these exact accusations in full knowledge that they don't believe a word of what they're saying and that nobody can tell the difference because it's not based in evidence, it's based in subjective claims of perception and pointing in the direction of vague systems and saying you're upholding this or engaging in some kind of behavior that can be characterized as upholding this rather than something quantifiable like that you expressed a genuine, you know, opinion of racial superiority or inferiority or acted in a discriminatory way that a court might agree with, for example. So I can't guess what their motivations are, but this is the fundamental thing that has to be discussed is that the word, you want to think of the word racism, and there are a billion words, and maybe not quite a billion, but there are a lot of words in their kind of lexicon that, like white supremacy is another one, democracy is even another one, that you have to approach with tremendous caution because they have occupied them. And I want people to think of those words, and I wish I'd put this in the book, as though, you know, think if we're in World War II and we're looking at the map of Europe, that there's the German-occupied territory and then there's the Allied-occupied territory. words, actually, their conceptual range is actually like a territory in this kind of abstract space. And they have occupied the territory of the word racist to a very strong degree. So you are on losing ground. It's like you've entered into so-called no man's land or whatever. Actually, you've entered into enemy territory to try to manipulate or use that word one way or another. So it should sting to be called a racist. And good, normal people understand this and are not down with what racism truly represents. But the term itself has become occupied territory and is very tricky to use. It requires what Christians are very good about talking about is a lot of discernment to understand when you've been called a racist. Can you reflect quickly and decide that you actually did or didn't do something, you know, racially insensitive or inappropriate? Or is it an example of the very first thing I put in the book, that this is a critical race theorist using a term because they want to control you or some circumstance you're involved in? And you have to become discerning. The word itself, its conceptual range, is occupied territory by an aggressive enemy. And so you have to become discerning to determine when it's being used authentically and when it's being used in a kind of activist way. And whether the person doing that is an honest broker who believes in crazy things or a cynical grifter is even harder to determine. And something I generally don't try to do unless the evidence is overwhelming that they are cynical and manipulative.
Now, according to critical race theory, I'm supposed to evaluate institutions not according to their stated principles, right? But according to what the practical outcomes are. So if some institution appears to have completely race-neutral principles, that is all just a smokescreen if the result is a racially disparate outcome. I know this might sound like a silly question, but what does that mean for, let's say, hockey as versus football, or opera houses, you know, versus a comedy club? I'm sure there are racially different sorts of people who attend those things. But since that doesn't affect somebody's prosperity, do they just not care? I mean, obviously there are, I'm not sure what my question is, but I guess my question is, I see racial disparities in attendance and in different, in the types of TV programs that blacks and whites watch. The New York Post did a study of that, and they found that there was only one TV show that both had in their top 10. That was Monday Night Football. Okay, but that's benign. Can we just leave that alone? Or I'm not even sure what I'm asking, because I can't make sense of any of this.
No, everything is racist. And they will point out these disparities, though. They've had relatively little success going after hockey. They've had more success going after the NFL and NBA. They have been very clear, though, that things like opera, outdoorsmanship type activities, or camping or hiking or trail running or any of these kind of things that are disproportionately white, biking, they just, in fact, in King County, Washington, which is where Seattle is, they just removed the requirement for bicyclists to wear helmets. And the reason wasn't because of some libertarian principle that people should be free to choose for themselves and make their own decision. It's for racial equity, because more black people can't afford to ride a bicycle because they can't afford to buy a helmet, is what they're claiming. And so, you know, the goal is always to accuse these things of being racist, but they go after, you know, they went after classical music in general and Beethoven very much in specific. They've gone after Shakespeare, but in very much specific, with the curriculum overall being too white and very much in general. And so, you know, really what they're doing is looking for the opportunity to call anything racist, because anything they call racist, they can then use their tools to gain leverage over it and to gain power over it. The entire thing has to be understood as a power grab. The claim to racism, as we spoke about at the beginning of the interview, is just, it's actually ludicrous on its face. You have to go into a kind of almost magical structural world, as outlined in Marx's theory, to even be able to try to make sense of it, which I can do, and people who read the book will be able to do to a degree after they read it, but it's ludicrous on its face. And so you have to understand that it's just like all of the other Marxist manipulations in the past. It's just a cynical power grab. It is just an attempt to manipulate. So anywhere they can find that advantage, and anywhere that it, in particular, that it will work, that's where they'll press the hardest. So if they can accuse, say, a late night TV host or something like this of being racist and he's going to apologize, then they know that that's a weak spot and they're just going to press harder on it. If you look at their behavior, you can see that it's actually a program designed to grab power and to use calling people racist as the mechanism to do it.
Well, let's finish our discussion with this. In which direction do you think things are trending? Obviously, there's been a lot of negative press for critical race theory, such that people have been forced to resort to, it's not being taught in schools. What are you talking about? And then when it's banned in schools, hey, how dare you? I mean, they can't even make sense of their own position. But has that been enough?
I actually think that we have passed the inflection point. So I kind of wish, I said that I published the book, self-published through the company for speed. And I kind of wish I could have got it out a couple of months earlier. I do believe that we've actually passed the inflection point in the critical race theory, except through coercion and force, whether that's economic or physical, is on its way out. It will be forced into institutions, especially public schools are particularly vulnerable to it. Also, corporations and other major institutions that care about these things are being tied up through these so-called ESG investment metrics that are being used by all the big businesses and the big banks now. S is for social in ESG, and social is shorthand for social justice. And critical race theory is the racial component of how your ESG score is being calculated or as part of it. So it's being forced through kind of economic manipulation and through the heavy hand of the state, if you look at the public schools or other public institutions like the military. But everywhere else, it's at the level of the grassroots or at the bottom, it has died. It is almost, I would say, conceptually, like the idea is public enemy number one currently in our society. And I think it will not survive except where it can be forced upon people where accountability is low. We have very little accountability against corporations. We have very little we can leverage against corporations, and we have very little accountability often that we can leverage against the state, despite being supposedly a constitutional republic that's functioning and operates with the consent of the governed. And so those kinds of places are going to see it continue to intensify, whereas everywhere else, people are going to turn away from it and become increasingly aware of what it is. And that's really why I wrote the book, just to kind of put that pin in the end of this, is I wrote the book so that people could be aware of what this really is, where it came from, and how it works, so that they can continue to understand that it's very important to push this out of A, their thinking, B, society, and C, these institutions where it will be hardest to remove.
Well, as we've seen, if you're going to say that this is a kind of a development or perversion of Marxism, that goes to show that just when you think something is dead, it has a way of just coming on back. So there is always value. Even if the thing appeared to us to be absolutely dead, there is still value in chronicling it to prevent it from coming back to life, because it has a habit of doing so. And of course, a major help in keeping it, we hope, on the decline, I am certain will be your book, Race Marxism, The Truth About Critical Race Theory and Practice, which I will link to on our show notes page, tomwoods.com/2072. Thank you very much, James. I know this is a crazy busy week for you, but I appreciate you making time for the old Tom Woods show.
Yeah, always glad to be here, Tom.
All right, everybody. Tomorrow we've got a case involving the Supremacy Clause, the Second Amendment, state resistance to federal overreach. Very interesting story coming out of Missouri for you. And it, I think, could be a model for other states. So very much worth listening to. And if you like and appreciate the kinds of things that go on here on the Tom Woods Show, I sure would be delighted if you joined me as a supporting listener. And one of the many benefits you get is membership inside the Tom Woods Show Elite, the uncensored group for smart people, or even just people who would like to be smart someday, where we have fun, interesting conversations with like-minded, normal people. If that sounds like the place for you, then check out supportinglisteners.com. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.